As part of this week's show, designer Anne Frank of Crossing Centuries has created a special freebie download design just for FiberTalk listeners. To download the chart, go to crossing-centuries.com, Anne Frank's website, crossing-centuries.com, and there will be a link in the show notes for this podcast, and you can download the chart. And then, of course, we would recommend if you need materials that you contact Kim at Sassy Jack Stitchery, sassyjackstitchery.com, and Kim will fix you up. And now on to our conversation with Anne Frank. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for the needlework artists. Our artist this week from Crossing Centuries, Anne Frank. Anne, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Oh, so many things that you make. We're going to be here for a week.
Yeah.
Let's see. We have 4-H clothing sewing. We have cake decorating, loop pot holders. Oh, man, I'm a master at that. Rug hooking, but basket weaving. And then, of course, we're going to have some needlework in here, too. But we got to know about this basket weaving thing, because the pictures of your baskets, they're stunning. What? How'd you ever get hooked into that?
Thank you for that. Thank you. Well, I took my very first basket class in craft class at 4-H Camp Shankatunk near Delhi, New York in the 1970s. You know, you could pick the activities that you wanted to do for the week, and mine was always craft. I always wanted to do the craft classes. Made a basket. I still have it. My mother kept it, which I think is funny. My sister made one. She threw my sister's away. So I guess I was destined to be the basket weaver. Mine might have turned out maybe a little bit better. So that was in the 1970s. Okay. Didn't do another thing with it. Fast forward to the early 90s. I was newly married. My husband and I met in college. I was working during the day. He was working second shift. I was bored. I'm like, what am I going to do? Local craft store had a basket class. And I thought, I'm going to sign up for that. That sounds kind of cool. Went to the first class, made the basket. Bought some more materials, bought some patterns, went home, sat on the living room floor, and I started going through that book, making every basket that was in the book to see if I could do it. And from that, probably 3 or 4 years, I did that. And then my dad said to me, why don't you try doing some craft shows, which I thought was, oh, you're sick of getting baskets from me, aren't you? You want me to sell these now.
Every Christmas present, for crying out loud.
Right. Exactly. So I started doing shows. You know, craft shows were really big in the 90s. And I would weave and weave and weave and then go with my... I always felt like once I got there, I should have been weaving harder than I was. I should have had more inventory. But I did that for a while.
Did that sell? Was that a profitable thing? It seems like an awful lot of work to do those shows to make money.
It really was not profitable.
Okay, there, just answered the question.
Yeah,
that's okay.
It's more fun than anything. And I still do a few shows a year, but it's more of an advertising expense that I have, because I don't make... I can sell so much more if I just post it on my Instagram, rather than going to the trouble of, you know, filling the car up with gas, loading everything up, spending the night, feeding my employee, which would be my husband. You know, I always have to take him out to eat. No, I never make any money. So it's a loss for me, but it's still fun. And I love talking to people. I like that interaction of talking to people when I'm vending somewhere.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. So there's some pluses to it. Because, yeah, the people who do that stuff all the time. And yeah, I remember in the 90s, yeah, you could find one about every other day. And you could see people who are just veterans of it. And every time I'd look at them, there is no way you're making money. You got to be just doing this just to get out. Because you can't make enough stuff and sell enough stuff to be truly profitable. So, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So it wasn't that great. I mean, it was still fun.
Well, but as a marketing, you know, if you view it as a marketing promotional tool, you know, that puts a whole different color on it.
It does.
Yeah.
It does. So early, now we're to the mid 90s. In 1997, our middle child was born, and we decided that I would be a stay-at-home mom at that point. Daycare for two children was just crazy expensive. My in-laws lived next door to the basket shop manager for Ohio's largest living history museum. So I knew this gal that lived next door to my in-laws, and she was always asking me, won't you come and weave at the Village for me?
Mm.
Well, I work full time. I have one child. That means that I have to give up a Saturday or a Sunday to come out and work there. I couldn't do it. So when we decided I'd be a stay-at-home mom, I get a call from her, and she says, so I was talking to your mother-in-law, and she says that you're going to be staying home. And I've already arranged with her that she'll keep your kids on Friday so that you can come work for me.
Oh, come on. Really?
That is a true story.
Wow.
So how can you say no to that, right?
Right.
You know, I couldn't say no to that. So I dug the sewing machine out, made myself an 1860s day dress that I could wear to work because you had to be in costume at work, which was interesting in August when it was 100 degrees and there's no air conditioning and you can't wear short sleeves. Your dresses had to be long sleeve. Ugh. And, you know, there's 2.5 yards of fabric in the skirt. You have to wear petticoats to make the dress look correct. You have to wear tights and boots because that's what would have been worn.
You're dripping sweat before you even start. Oh,
you are. So we would have thousands of visitors come through every week. Some weeks it would be 10, 20,000 people that would come through. And as a docent, I was required to weave and demonstrate my craft and talk to the people that were coming in as visitors. We had lots and lots of school children, especially on Fridays. They didn't tell me that that was the big school field trip day when I took that job. So I was the one, which was fine. I had the school kids on Fridays. So I could teach and show them. I would hand a basket over to kids and let them try a row or two of weaving. And I did that for about 13 years while our kids were little. And when I left because I think I had been warm enough for the summers, and I just decided I don't want to do this anymore. And I started selling on Etsy at that point. And it was more lucrative for me to not have to actually drive somewhere to weave for the day.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 2009. So 2010 was really the first month that my basket weaving venture started online on Etsy in January of 2010.
Do you get to be a better weaver in those conditions when you're demonstrating all the time, or does your skill level just kind of plateau?
100%. I got better.
Okay.
100%. It was a requirement to be a weaver that you knew how to weave, and
that's good.
You know, I had done craft shows and I was fine. But what was interesting is I had firsthand, I could see what was selling, you know, what the top sellers were, that interaction with the customers saying, oh, this is so neat, but what would I do with this? That was always the biggest question of people. Oh, that's such a pretty basket, but what would I do with it? Well, you know, there's no limit to what you can use a basket for. You know, it can be decorative. You can use it. You can use it for storage. So, yes, definitely honing, I would say. I honed my craft more working at the Village. And in the 90s, it was all about dyed reed. And, you know, the navy blues, the burgundies, and the greens were accent in all of the baskets that sold. And it's funny now when I see one, I'm like, yep, that was made in the 90s because it usually includes those three colors. But that's what sold, so that's what you made.
Right.
Is it you making these baskets from scratch? I mean, are you like getting the reeds or whatever and preparing them, or do you buy the raw materials kind of already ready to go for weaving?
Well, I've done both. Okay. So what you see on my Instagram and on my website, which doesn't, I'm on vacation at the moment, that is imported from Indonesia. And the reed that I use is rattan. And it's the same material. If you think about a chair that has a caned seat or a caned back, the woven cane in an antique chair, the cane is the bark of the vine. And the reed is what's on the inside. Old Victorian antique furniture was made from reed. Now it's made from plastic, which I get, you know, it's sitting outside. Plastic's going to last a lot longer, but the antique stuff is actually reed. And that's what I use for 99.9% of my basket weaving is rattan reed. Something fun that my husband and I did was we did an ash camp. So we had a basket weaver from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan come to the village, and he showed us how to hand pound a black ash log into strips that you could use for weaving.
Whoa.
That was very interesting, very time consuming. We're talking 3 weeks from log to basket.
Oh.
Yeah. And that's how the Native American Indians would have made theirs. Which was very, very interesting. Like, who figured out that you could separate the rings on an ash tree, peel them apart, and cut them into strips? Like, how did they figure this out? That's fascinating to me. How did they figure this out?
So you take an ash log, and you basically peel it like an onion?
Kind of. The first thing that you have to do, you have to soak it. It has to be wet. So if you have a creek behind your house, that would be great. Throw that log in there. You're going to peel the bark off and burn the bark. Then what you do is you're pounding the log. Say it's lying in front of you and you're going to pound it from one end of the log to the other in about a 3-inch strip all the way down that log. And then you're going to turn the log and you're going to start again at the say the top or the left side, pound that 3-inch strip all the way down. If it's a 7-foot log, you're going to go all the way down to the other end, turn it, and you keep doing that. That releases the growth rings from each other. And that's what you're dealing with is the growth rings.
Huh.
So you're separating the growth rings.
Oh, that is amazing.
Wow.
It's fascinating to see this done. Absolutely fascinating. And the baskets that I have that are made from hand-pounded black ash, I cherish.
Wow. Oh. How cool. Now, Beth, you've got a river nearby. You could do that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The thing is, I do have a friend who makes, that's what she likes to do, baskets as a hobby. And I've got to ask her if she's ever tried that. She's crazier than I am. She might have. So how many baskets do you get out of like one log approximately?
Well, you know, depending on the circumference and the length, you could probably get, I don't know, 30 baskets, probably, you know, a medium sized. You're going to have a lot of waste with that, because as you come through knots, it's difficult to cut a straight line through a knot as you're trying to separate these pieces then that you weave with. But it's so rewarding when you start peeling the rings. So you start at one end of that strip that you just peeled off. You start at one end and you're pulling on both sides of that. And it is a challenge to maintain so that you have the left and the right pieces end up the same thickness. You need to be peeling the ring at the middle point. There's a huge learning curve to this. Let me just say that, a huge learning curve. But the whole prep work takes, you know, 100 times longer than it takes to make a basket.
Yeah. But when you make one of those baskets, just as sturdy and durable as you can imagine, I mean, gotta be.
Oh yeah, yep, they would be. And the that and the white oak that is used more predominantly in the Midwest, Missouri area, both those. That's usually what you see in the antique stores, and the old rib baskets are either going to be black ash or white oak.
Huh. Wow.
And they've lasted all this time. You know, they could be 100+ years old.
Yeah. Huh. Harder to weave with that than reed?
No.
No?
No, the weaving is no difference.
Okay.
You do have to take account for different. It might be thicker. The oak might be a little bit. It's going to be a little bit thicker. So, but you'll account for that in the type of basket that you're making. Like, you wouldn't try and make something tiny and fancy out of something really thick either. So as long as you prepare your material for the finished product, you'll be okay.
Sounds like it's. Like, it's, you almost have to be a blacksmith just to get the wood separated, though. Jeez.
That's a good way to think about it. Very good way to think about it.
Wow. What an experience. Oh. Okay. There you go, Beth. Put that down. That's your next thing.
Mm-hmm. That's my next project is to go and fell a oak and pound it.
Well, and the sad thing about the black ash is the emerald ash borer is now creating havoc with the inventory that you can, you know, that's available. Is that tree going to become extinct? Will we ever be able to do this into decades into the future? I don't know.
Yeah, those things. I live in St. Louis now, and I used to live northwest of Chicago. And, I can't tell you how it was an old river town I lived in. I can't tell you how many ash trees, giant old things that all had to come down because of that insect. Oh boy, it was just criminal.
It is.
And all that wood and, you know, you can't use the, we had to get rid of the wood because, it's a shame. So you're the docent, but then you realize, wait a minute, if I'm going to make baskets, I'm going to at least make money at this. So you really cranked up your basket making business?
Correct. Yep. Starting out on Etsy. I did that for a while. And then 2019, I decided I had enough of Etsy's fees. And I was going to do my own website.
Stand in line for that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was paying hundreds of dollars in fees every month to them. And I'm thinking, why is that not in my pocket? Why is it in theirs? Because I'm, through my social media, I'm driving my own traffic. They are doing very little to help market me.
Yeah.
And if I'm sending people there, you know, it's like shooting myself in the foot. So I started my own website. The $80 that I paid a month, or that I do pay a month for my website, is very small in comparison to what I was paying for Etsy. So I'm glad to pay that. You know, web hosting, it gives me shipping calculator. They take care of my credit card payments. And it's just been a great venture for me to go off on my own. And I still have a presence on Etsy, but I only sell select baskets on Etsy.
Okay.
I won't give them the profit of certain baskets. And they started advertising one of them for me, and they were charging me $10. I couldn't opt out. At the level that I sell at, you could not opt out of Etsy advertising. So they ding their big sellers is what they do. That if you sell over $10,000 a year in sales, you can't opt out. They were charging $10 to advertise this for me that I didn't even want them to do. On a $60 basket. And I can't do that anymore. I'm not going to just turn that over to you.
Right.
And so that's why I have a select number of baskets on Etsy. And I won't sell that one on Etsy anymore. Of course they would sell it because it was a great, or I'm sorry, that they would advertise it because it was a great seller. So of course they're going to advertise it and then want more of my cut. So that was what prompted me to do my own website. Etsy was great. I loved Etsy back in the early 2010s. Loved it. I still like it. I shop on Etsy. I love unique artisan created items. but now Etsy is so crowded with people that are selling trademarked items that they don't have license for. It just has become to me kind of, I mean, you have to hunt and search for the unique creator anymore on Etsy.
Yeah, it's definitely gotten away from its core origin.
It has.
Yeah, and it's too bad. And that I've read and heard many a story of that kind of greed. It's like they've just lost their perspective. It's too bad. Really a great idea, but I'm not sure it's heading in the right direction these days.
Definitely a great idea for who it was intended to, the small maker.
Yeah. Yeah. So now you've got your own website, you're doing your own marketing, and actually taking in all the money for the sales.
Right.
What a novel approach.
But I had to build that. You know, it was not an overnight thing. I think so many people, when they try this maker path, that they think, oh, I'm going to put it out there and people are going to flock to me and it's just going to sell. Mm-hmm. Well, that might be one in a million, but the other 900,000 people, you have to market yourself. It comes down to marketing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And having a product that people want.
Yeah, that helps. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Did you ever attend the Nashville market then? The needlework market in Nashville?
As a basket weaver?
Mm-hmm.
No. I could not handle that kind of quantity.
Okay.
I have to keep a cap on what I will do because I can't weave all the time. So I do tend to keep my sales at a certain level. I can only handle so much.
What's that like raising a family, making baskets and integrating that into raising a family? That's got to be quite a juggling act.
I have sat at baseball games in the summertime with a bucket of water and baskets to put rims on them because I had baskets that needed to get done and get shipped out.
There we go. Dedication.
Yep.
Yeah, because I was thinking that wouldn't be making a basket, because I've made a few, very, very few. And you need water. And I was thinking, well, when she went to a baseball game, I could just see you. But at least kind of cool, because you'd have the water there. You're kind of in.
Yep. Yep.
In a baseball game and weaving. That's great.
It was always a conversation starter too. Let me tell you, you know, people would come up and want to see it. It fascinates people to when you're sitting and weaving and demonstrating. And I love to hand it over to people who, and I don't mean this in a mean way, but would say, oh, you know, I made a basket in third grade. That's so easy. And that was always, why don't you weave a couple rows right now? You know, here, you know, you've done it. Go put in a couple rows for me. And I always did it nicely. Just to point out that, oh, maybe it's not as easy as I thought it was. You have to have tension. Your tension has to be correct or you're going to have sloping sides on a basket. Who wants a basket that has the ends that are either flaring out or pulling in? There's definitely, you know, people joke about basket weaving classes, but there is an art to it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I quit is that my son wanted to learn, my oldest. And so I got some supplies and we invested. He was much better at it than I was. His tension was way better, but I just couldn't get that right. My baskets would kind of, you could look at them. They kind of all lean to one side.
Remember when I said this in the beginning that my basket's still here and my sister's got thrown away? same type thing there. So
No, and that's when I decided, yeah, this isn't for me. I can't get these to ever come out. Great.
Well, and I will share because I think that most fiber artists would enjoy this part. If they have my baskets, they know I do use a stain on my baskets, and it's black walnut hulls that I cook on my kitchen stove with water. And that is the stain that I use on my baskets.
Oh.
We used to go out in the fall and collect black walnuts. You know, you'd see them on the edge of the road or on golf courses, and we would go out and collect those by the bagfuls. And then I decided, you know what, I can buy these that someone else has already done this and ground them up. And I will admit right here, I don't go out and collect my own anymore. I just need such a large inventory of walnuts that it makes more sense to buy the powdered walnuts. And I use that. So it's still a natural dye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've done that too, where, you know, you soak them in a bucket for a while and you're like, uh-huh. Oh, those walnuts sitting there. It's time to go strain them.
Yep.
Concentrate them. Why am I doing this?
Well, this is amazing to me. So if I buy an 1803 Ohio Farm basket, I'm not getting some factory manufactured thing. It's the real deal from stem to stern then. Wow.
It is.
And you got your husband making wood bases?
He does. Any of the baskets that I have, the tote baskets in particular, I use a wood base on so that they support more weight. I've tried to think back to that initial that I said about, you know, people coming in and saying, oh, this is neat. What would I use it for? And also listening to what they wanted. The rug hookers were a huge event at the village that I worked at as a docent. They actually have a whole week-long event. It's coming up here in August for rug hookers. And the rug hookers would come in and they always wanted the big baskets and they wanted it to carry their frames and their wool and their patterns. So I heard what they were saying and created the tote basket that I make, and my husband cuts those bases, and he has cut hundreds of those bases for me. He uses a router to cut a slot into them for me. He sands them. Yep, he does all that for me.
Truly a family effort. That's fantastic.
It is.
All right, so where does the needlework come into this thing? Have you been, has that been the escape hobby all along, or?
Maybe. I started cross-stitching in the summer of 1987. So back in the geese days of the 80s, when everything was baby blue or that dusty blue and geese were all over everything, we were in college. And here we go again. I was sitting at softball games. My husband, well, he was my boyfriend at the time, was a college baseball player, and he played softball in the summertime. And I, that very first thing that I cross-stitched, I took to softball games and I sat there cross-stitching while he played in weekend softball tournaments. I had made that. I was going to give it to my nephew when he was born, and then I got it done. And I decided I put so many hours into this, I'm going to save it for my own children.
Yeah.
So I started cross-stitching in the 80s, and I have pretty much cross-stitched ever since. I can't sit still. I have to have something in my hands at all times to do.
I know that feeling. So what do you like to stitch now? Do you have a preference?
I prefer to stitch, well, my favorite, if you would ask me, would be any marking sampler. Just goes right to my heart. I love marking samplers. The innocence of the children that stitched them and the cute little mistakes. I hate to even use the word mistake, but the personalization, let's call it that, the personalization of their marking samplers, that maybe they left out a letter. Maybe two or three letters are stitched higher than all the rest of them. The spacing might not be the same across a row. That just really hits home for me. I love that. So marking samplers are my favorite.
I'm writing that down. Those are personalizations. Because to me, that's I'm a kid. I want to be out of here. I'm not sitting here doing this. Personalizations. That's what those are. Okay. You've done it.
Yes. Because they really aren't mistakes.
Right.
You know, they really, truly aren't. Maybe some people might think that, but I don't. And that's where I get that word personalizations.
They do make them uniquely, though. They show the individual that stitch them, I think, is what makes them so much.
Yes. And when you think about these, the girls and boys, there are boys that stitched marking samplers. They were maybe 8 years old, younger. Of course, some of them might have been a little bit older, but, you know, they're young. Young children were creating these marking samplers. And it just, to me, it's so sweet.
So what gets you hooked on those? Is it obviously the kid part of it, but is it the history too? Did you start collecting them?
I think it is. I do have a collection. I think it's the primitive nature of them. My home is decorated in a very primitive antique style. The dirtier and cruddier something is, the more I love it. My children tell me that when I'm gone, they will be burning most of my furniture because they don't appreciate. You know, I like things that are dinged up and have been used, and you can tell that they served a function in someone's lifetime. And now I'm the caretaker of these items. Unfortunately, sounds like they're headed to a bonfire when I'm gone. But so marking samplers, they have faded. So many of them have faded, you know, over time, over the 150 years that they've been around. I love that. It's old. It's antique. It's history. I love history. Obviously, you know, I did work at a living history museum. So that all is, I guess, my love of antique samplers.
What was the first one you bought?
My very first one is actually one that was in my family.
Oh.
So I do have a family marking sampler. The very first one that I bought is my next release, and her name is Maria Barton. She stitched this in England. I know all about Maria. I found her on the internet through some searches. There was a little bit of history written on the back of the frame. She has a very interesting middle name, and her husband had his last name wasn't Smith. So it was easy to find her, done in silks. And the fact that it's an English sampler, I just love it. So she's the first one that I bought.
So how do we transition into reproducing samplers? I mean, you're making baskets, and now you're going to reproduce samplers. How do you make that transition?
Well, I found the level of weaving that I've done for the last few years, my hands will ache. Now I'm not getting younger, and my hands will ache after a weekend of weaving. And I don't want to give up my cross stitching and my rug hooking. As you know, hopefully I have several more decades that I'm going to be around, and I want to be able to do these things, and I don't want to ruin my hands by making so many baskets. So I decided, you know what? I've stitched how many of these samplers from other designers, and I want to share my collection with other stitchers that might like the same style that I like. And I definitely have a style. As I said, mine are muted colors. I don't get into the bright, vibrant samplers. I know that there's a market for that. That's great. I appreciate them. They're gorgeous. But for me, the blues, the browns, the creams, that speaks to me.
So you sit down. Was the first one you did the family sampler? Is that the first one you charted?
I do have that one charted. I've never released that one. No. That may be a free that I offer. I have a couple freebies that I'm going to be offering, one in conjunction with our talk today. I will have one on my website that will be a free download over the weekend, as you know, in doing with conjunction with this. I will tell you, it's not an antique. It's an original from right out of my head. It has historic kind of significance to it, maybe a little bit. Maybe that's a stretch, but an original design that I'm going to release in celebration of this talk.
So, oh, great. Great.
the charting software has been a learning curve for me. That has been a challenge. I've kind of gotten the hang of that, but that's been a learning curve.
Yeah, I think it is for everyone, whether they'll admit it or not. I don't think you just sit down and just start doing that. No. I have a small program that I use to chart words, and it took me a minute to figure out how to get something that would print out that I could actually use. Yeah, it's not always as straightforward as it looks. No.
No, I would agree with you. It's not. But it's been so much fun to chart them. I don't know how you feel with doing your letters that you said that you do, but it's just, it's so much
fun. I'll tell you how I feel. I do as little as I need to do. Oh. That's how I feel.
I think it's been fun as you inspect these samplers, each individual element. You might not see that when you're looking at the overall sampler hanging on a wall or sitting on your mantle. But when you look at each element, each letter, each row, each line that the stitcher put in here, it's fascinating. Again, back to that, like, why did you choose to do this? And, well, this is interesting. It just, to me, that's, again, fascinating.
And so when you do these things, what are we doing them on? Linen, Aida, silks, cottons?
I am pretty much a linen gal anymore. Everybody's familiar with the Prairie Schooler that has been around forever. I love Prairie Schooler. I always dedicate Prairie Schoolers to Aida cloth because I feel that those two go together. Mm-hmm. I have a Santa tree that's Prairie Schooler, and they're all Aida that are on there. Love that. For my samplers, I do use linen. I prefer anymore. I've gotten into the high count linen, the 50s, 56 counts. I love those, but I'm doing, as I reproduce these, I'm doing them on lower counts because I know that that's more what the market is looking for. Lydia Phelps. I have Lydia on my Instagram account, which is crossing_centuries. I stitch Lydia two different ways. I stitch Lydia on 40 count with three different hand dyed cottons. And then I also stitched Lydia on a 30 count hand dyed, and I used number 12 Veldani. Now, I'm sure that there's people that would say, oh, you used a 12 count Veldani. You don't do that. Well, I did. And why can't you? You know, right. These schoolgirls were stitching with wool. I have one now that I'm working on that she did with wool, and it's huge. You know, the wool is so bulky on the linen. I love how that looks. Why can't I use number 12 Veldani on 30 count? I just used one strand. I love how it looked. It's variegated, and the difference between the two Lydias I like. And my point was to encourage people, make it your own. Do what you want to do with it. Just because I stitched the original on 40 count with three different hand dyes, do it a different way. Make it your own. Increase the linen count. Make it even smaller. Go bigger. Use a different, unexpected floss or thread or fabric.
Yeah, why not? Why not? Do you research these to have a story to go with it, or are you just more interested in producing the chart?
No, I like the story with it. The first two that I did, I couldn't find the two specific gals. I couldn't find Lydia and I couldn't find Jane. I found some Lydias and Phelps and some Jane Crowls. I'm not positive they found the exact girls. The next three, four samplers I have, I know quite a bit about all four of the girls. Two that I found recently are Fanny Stoner and Susanna Harnish. And they both, these samplers came from Pennsylvania. They were Pennsylvania Mennonite and stitched these samplers. And I can't wait to share them. I just can't stitch fast enough to get these all out to share with everyone. So I know both those girls. And it's fun that I feel like I know them. I've gotten to know them through their genealogies and their children, their who they married. Uh-huh. For example, Susanna married someone with the same name. So I need to find out, trace them back. Were they first cousins, second cousins? How were they related?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would think that that brings life to the sampler when you have the story behind it. Yes.
It does. It does.
And so are these mainly cross-stitched then, the marking samplers?
For the most part, yes. A lot of times the rows separating the alphabets or the different, if you will, sections of a chart, maybe they did the alphabet and then they've done the alphabet again, or they've put a little verse in. A lot of times the horizontal rows will be a specialty stitch that they included. One I have the queen stitch in that's coming up, one Algerian eye. So they did include a few different stitches, but as smaller portions of the chart or the sampler that they did.
What prompted you to make this into a business? Just you wanted to share these things, and so why not?
I do.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to share them.
Yeah.
And if I share them, and I don't want this to sound greedy, but if I sell them and I can make back what I paid for the sampler, that allows me to buy another sampler that I can add to my collection and reproduce that as well. So right. It's kind of money to fuel my hobby, basically, is what this is.
Hey, we all have that fantasy. You're just making it work. Yeah. Good for you.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. I've told my wife many times, you know, oh yeah, I'm making enough to pay for the hobby. she handles the books and she just gives me that look like, sure you are.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Yeah.
Just keep singing the song and that's the way it'll be. Yeah. Yep.
Well, so far it's been okay. And of course, you know, as we talked about my baskets, that supported my rug hooking hobby. I don't know how familiar you are with rug hooking, but rug hooking is an expensive hobby. Wool is expensive.
Yeah. See, that's where because this is the real rug hooking. Because the first time that was mentioned to me, I just remembered back in the 70s or whatever it was, where people were using those little short clips of yarn and making these rugs, but you're doing the real thing, right?
Right. That was latch hooking.
There, that's the word. Yes.
Yep. Yeah. Latch hooking, and rug hooking is strips of wool being pulled through a linen back, usually linen. I prefer linen as my foundation fabric. That you're pulling it through and creating the rugs, the mats with that. And again, wool is expensive per yard. And then once you start talking about getting a hand-dyed wool that adds texture and life and vibrancy, movement to your rug, that's even more expensive because someone has taken the time to hand-dye that wool.
So wait a second. Is it woven through, or is it like those latch hooks where you're kind of making a loop?
Think of a crochet hook, and that's okay. The hook that you use to, you put the hook down through the piece of linen. It's a, so we think cross stitch linen, think 30 count. Okay. So rug hooking linen is way, way bigger than that. So a lot more threads per inch. It's loose and kind of open, but you stick your hook or crochet hook down through that. You grab your strip of wool that might be cut into a quarter of an inch wide, and you pull that through and you make a little loop about a quarter of an inch wide, and then you, in the next like holes, you stick your hook back down in, pull that up again, and you're making little loops on the top side of the linen.
Okay. All right. But you don't step on those, do you? You say,
oh, I do. We do at our house. They feel amazing as you walk on them, especially I like to hook high. So I pull my strips through higher than an average person might do this. And I mean, my kids knew from early on that you don't step on them with your shoes on. You have to have bare feet or socks on your feet to step on them. And they are down. They're not in high traffic areas in my home, but they are on the floor. I know, after all that time, and then you let people step on them.
I know. I'm shaking my head.
My grandmother was a rug hooker. Here, I'm going to get off topic on you, but my grandmother was a rug hooker and hooked several room-sized rugs. And room-sized, I mean, like, I know, maybe 8x8 or 10x10. And I just can't imagine having the patience to sit. And she did what's called fine cut. So instead of a quarter of an inch, it might have been an eighth of an inch wide strips. So think about how many strips it takes you to get to 10 feet across when your piece of wool is an eighth of an inch wide.
Holy smokes.
And I'm mad.
And she's one of those, I think that I got a lot of my creativity from her. She would buy wool clothing, cut off the buttons, take out the zippers. She would either use the wool as is, or she did a lot of dyeing of her own wool.
And that's a process too, because I dye cotton fabric and I've dyed linen, but wool, you have to heat it.
You do.
And that's a whole nother step that I don't want to do.
And you have to be careful, because if you overheat it, you will felt it. And then you can't use it for rug hooking. So you're basically, they call it fulling the wool as you heat it. But you don't want to felt it. So, yep, you've got to use heat to dye it. You have to soak it overnight. So you kind of have to plan ahead that you have to have your wool wet. And it needs to be really wet by soaking overnight with a couple of squirts of dish soap like Dawn. And then you dye it from there.
That's a whole nother process and a whole nother steps than I'm willing to take. You know, I like it if I I mix my dyes, throw it in the dye bath, and away we go. You know,
I hear you, Beth. That's why I typically buy the hand dyed modeled wools when I rug hook.
Right. All right. Now I'm wondering. So you have a full time job. You weave baskets. You do cross stitch. You chart reproduction samplers, and you hook rugs, and
I
you
do.
Sleep from 2 to 4 in the morning.
Just about.
Okay. All right.
Should I share with you that I played 9 holes of golf this morning before I got on with you? I had Friday off, so.
Oh man, I feel lazy. Wow. Are all these, I mean, do you keep all of this going, or do you go in waves with these different activities?
Oh, you know, everybody talks about the whips that they have, and I'm not a huge whip person because I might have 4 or 5 cross-stitch things charted. Like, I always have one in my purse. You have to have a project in your purse so that if you get caught somewhere waiting, you have something to do. So I have a purse project. And that's always a small, maybe I'm filling in with one color that I've got it outlined and I can fill in. I have something in the living room by the chair. I have something in the family room by a chair. I probably have that many rug hooking projects started. I don't have any baskets that aren't finished, because those I usually always start and finish the same day. But yeah, you have to have choices. That's my thing, is you might not feel like doing something one day, and it's called choices. It's, you know, like the girls personalized their samplers. I have choices.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to get stitching one thing or doing just one thing. I mean, you have to have, there's always option. Always option.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I'm feeling better. Yeah. That's what these are all. All this stuff around
choices.
Me is choices.
Yep.
Yeah. See? I'm going to write that down for my wife, too. Yeah.
I don't know if she'll agree, but, you know, my husband Wendy, we like, why don't you finish something?
Yeah, I'll just get that look. Yeah, sure it is. Sure it's choices. Just go for it. Yeah. Convince yourself. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. You know, if I can rationalize it like that, I can believe it. So I have choices.
Well, all right. So, but it seems like your husband has a woodworking hobby too. So you're not alone in this thing.
He does. His hobby would be more golf than woodworking.
Oh.
When he has to do it for me, he will pull out the tools, but he does know how to do all the woodworking.
Okay. But he'd rather be out on the course. Okay.
Every day he'd rather be out on the course.
yeah. So, Crossing Centuries now fairly new. Is this, do you have some kind of a plan for releasing samplers like every couple months or what, how is this going to work for us?
That's my plan, is that it may not be every month, depending on the size of the sampler, but at least every other, I do have a plan of releasing. I do offer two varoons. I do have them professionally printed, or you can do a PDF download from my website. Either of those. I don't ship internationally. I've never shipped my baskets internationally. It just, that's a stress point for me. And I try and keep the stress points out of my life, and worrying about a certain box, if it's going to make it through customs and actually be delivered, I don't deal well with that. And that stresses me out. And I just decided I don't need to ship internationally. I'm sorry, international people, listeners. I get requests a lot and I turn them all down. And shipping, the cost of shipping internationally is also an issue. I'm sorry. I don't want to do it. And I decided that I'm not going to do it for my charts either, unless it might be a wholesale order. I did not wholesale my baskets. That was another way that I can control the number of sales that I had. I didn't need to wholesale. I would also like to get into the wholesaling of my charts. So that's on my business plan as well into the future. But at the moment, I do, everything is professionally printed. I do not print them on a home printer. It's heavyweight paper. My next ones will be Maria that I'm going to be releasing hopefully by the end of this weekend. She will actually be a booklet release, a color booklet rather than a folded chart, if that makes sense to you where I'm going with. It's not the standard size piece of paper folded with the color copy or color picture on it. It will be a full-sized paper heavyweight book with the chart stapled inside.
Mm-hmm. So by the time people hear this, then it will definitely be released then. That's great.
It should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Along with a freebie that I'm offering in conjunction.
Yeah. No, that's great. Now, when you do these charts, is there always a thread list for DMC, or how do you do that?
I need to put the DMC conversions in there. That was one thing that I neglected to do on my first two releases, but I will be doing that going forward. I prefer the hand dyeds, and I know everyone does not prefer hand dyed, but again, back to that, like the rug hooking, that gives you movement in your piece, that it's not flat. And we all stitched with DMC for how long? You know, I have every single color of DMC that there is. And it was great. And I guess in my personal stitching, I prefer the hand dyed, the weeks, the color, classic color works, and the general arts.
Yeah.
And that's what I use. But I will, in future charts, include a DMC conversion as well.
Wow. Okay. So are you actively buying samplers? I mean, is that something in your spare time that you're always looking for samplers to buy?
I am.
Because that's got to be a bit of a project too, just to find and buy one, right?
It is. I love to antique. Like I said, my home is primitive antiques. So I have a girlfriend. I have two girlfriends, actually, who go antiquing with me. And always looking for samplers. And luckily here lately, I have found three three samplers recently, which has been a stroke of luck for me. Maybe also making me think, oh, they were put in my path on purpose. So that was fun to stumble upon three when I, you know, I always have my eyes open for them. It's funny, I was in a booth. I also collect antique woven coverlets. That's a passion of mine. I love textiles. I saw one in a booth and I had just zeroed in on this coverlet, and my friend saw the sampler sitting there and she said, how could you even walk past this? I said, because I saw that blue coverlet over there. It was like a magnet to me. So the sampler came home with me. I left the coverlet, bought the sampler.
I was going to say, did the coverlet come over too? Just the sampler. Yeah. Funny.
And my coverlets are back. I mentioned this earlier. Browns and blues are my colors. And I know red is the popular thing in samplers and marking samplers. And I gravitate towards the blues and the browns. And the majority of my antique coverlets are blues. I like the blues and the creams.
Yeah. So are we, is it antique shops or estate sales or both?
Antique shops, antique shows that they'll host on a weekend.
Okay.
I will go to estate sales, but I have to tell you, I have not found anything great at estate sales. Lots of times now they'll post pictures online so that you can weed out what you don't want to go to. And estate sales for where I am have not been a source.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose that,
unfortunately,
I suppose that really is dependent on where you are in the country as to whether a sale will have old things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was lucky, these two that I bought that were from Pennsylvania, it was an antique dealer that was set up at a show, and wow, he had made a buying trip to Pennsylvania and bought them. And it's neat when you can talk to the actual dealer at a show like that, as opposed to an antique store where the dealer may or may not be there, and you know they'll have call the dealer for you. But it was he's the one that bought them in Pennsylvania, and so he had that information for me.
Yeah, yeah. What fun! What fun! You are never bored, I can tell. Yeah.
No, I am not bored. Like I said, I have to be doing something.
Yep. Well, that's great. Well, Anne, we really enjoyed this. Thanks for doing the show with us. And we get 1803 OhioFarmBaskets.com is where the baskets are at. And then crossing-centuries.com is where the samplers are at. And,
correct.
The rest of it, you'll just have to contact Anne directly, because she can only manage so many websites. It's just the way it is.
And if you follow me on 1803 Ohio Farm Baskets on Instagram, I do post a lot of my life other than basket weaving. It's not all baskets, baskets, baskets. It's my rug hooking. It's my antiquing. It's my cross stitch. I use it as kind of a diary of what's going on in my life right now, what I completed, maybe what I purchased. So I enjoy interacting with people on Instagram. I really like Instagram.
All right, there we have it. Anne, thanks so much, and thanks to everybody for listening.